Hello and welcome to the Courtney Turner podcast. My guest today is Dr. Jerome Corsi. We're going to be talking about his new book. It is called The Truth About Neo-Marxism, Cultural Maoism, and Anarchy, Exposing Woke Insanity in an Age of Disinformation. And I cannot recommend this book enough. I think he's written 30. I'm now going to want to go back and read his other work. This is a phenomenally comprehensive book. I have a book that I usually recommend for people as an intro to philosophy. It is by Justine Gardner. It is called Sophie's World, not Sophie's Choice, Sophie's World. And I usually recommend that as kind of like an intro to philosophy. This, I would say, possibly if you've never read any philosophy, start with that. And then this is really just a so incredibly comprehensive explanation of the entire field of Western philosophy and how we got to where we are today. So we're going to dive into some of that. He has a PhD from Harvard in political science, and he's got a super impressive resume. Worked in fields of finance and now telehealth medicine. And I also want to just remind you that if you like the work we're doing here, any support is really greatly appreciated. You can click on the links below and get any products that you feel aligned with that will support your health and will support the podcast. You can also just support me directly, do a give, send, go, buy me a coffee. I could use some coffee. You can send me snail mail to my P.O. Box. That's P.O. Box 680093, Franklin, Tennessee, 37068. Or you can send me a Venmo, which is a Courtney-Turner. That's at Courtney-Turner. You can buy some Element, Magic Dicol, and CrowdRank. So CrowdRank is an aggregate. You can create kind of your own news, like your own drudge, but it's a social media form. So you can find me there and show me some love on CrowdRank. Saunas, we're going to have a interview with the guy behind that sauna. I'm doing that later today, so that will be out for you shortly. RNCstore.com. On all of them, you can use the code Courts. So yeah. And also just liking, sharing, subscribing, all of that is super helpful and super appreciated. So we're going to bring on Dr. Jerome Corsi. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm fine. Good. Looking forward to the interview. Thank you.
Likewise. Yeah. So this is, we were just talking about this, is 350 pages about, and it is a very, very dense book. You pretty much left no stone unturned in terms of Western philosophy and political science. So what spawned you to write this book?
Well, the problem with the woke and trying to understand this critical race theory is that no one really knows where it came from. I mean, it's so bizarre. It's a whole fundamentally different worldview, and it has a long history emerging from philosophy, Western philosophy in particular. Yeah. And if you don't understand what they call the phenomenology, the worldview, the interior mental space in which this woke generation lives, yeah, you can't refute them. You can't argue with them. You can't demonstrate why it's so fundamentally wrong and evil. I think evil is actually appropriate because it's constructed to be, very complex. It comes from Marxism, but it has its roots back in pre-Socratic thinking. Mm-hmm. The key I picked on is, first of all, neo-Marxism, which is where it started, and then cultural Maoism, where it evolved, and anarchy, which is where it ends up. Mm-hmm. And I say it's exposing this woke insanity in an age of disinformation, because the other complication you've got here is that this is really postmodern thinking, which means that the standard of truth does not necessarily apply. It's a fundamentally different way of looking at reality.
Relativism.
Relativism, value relativism, subjectivity, projection of your own individual ideas and thoughts of reality on everybody else. But let's dive in wherever you want to start. I think it's incredibly important that people do understand this, because if we're going to run, it's a psychological operation. It's a it's a psyop,
and yes,
it's very, very seductive.
Yes,
it has captured a whole generation of Americans, without realizing that they've been seduced by a series of very brilliant thinkers who are, unfortunately, were also very destructive and very negative. Mm-hmm. And so as we get into it, my purpose is to inform people of how woke operates, destructive, how to defeat it. And if we don't go down this path, if we don't take this time to understand it, we're not going to be able to defeat it.
I couldn't agree more. So maybe we should start with that. How would you define woke?
Well, woke is a particular, it's Marxist, first of all. Mm-hmm. It comes out of predominantly a whole line of thinking that ends up being very almost psychotic, in that whatever your personal reality is, whatever you decide is real for you and who you are, your identity is then the focus of your entire life experience. And that's to be projected on others who have to celebrate your perception of yourself and operate as if you have the right to posit what's true and false, what's real, not real, it's important and not important. And that doesn't mean what's actually true. In other words, when the woke say that there's a scientific consensus that carbon dioxide and hydrocarbon fuels, which emit carbon dioxide, cause global warming, they do not mean that the scientific consensus is that all scientists agree. They know many scientists don't agree. What they're saying is that the consensus is by those who think properly, those who understand this particular Marxist vision of utopia, they all agree that it would be wrong to use hydrocarbon fuels and we should stop because these are going to ruin the earth. Now, it doesn't mean that scientifically or actually it's going to ruin the earth. It might not. So I'm sorry about that. I thought I had that turned off, but we'll go.
No worries.
At any rate, but so it's subjective. In other words, I'll give you one example. Okay, so we'll kind of, this is kind of jumping to the back of the book first, but this gender issue, the whole blurring of gender. So you say your sex is not your gender. Sexual organs are of physical organs, but your gender is how you behave in sex, what you do. It's performance determined. And so therefore you can be male or female, and yet transgender, because in fact, you say to yourself, well, this is the reality of how I express my sexuality. And then the subjective nature of that is you get points for all the discriminations that you have, because this you're viewed as coming from being oppressed by this capitalist society. So if you're a woman, you get points. Because women are all oppressed by men. Men oppress women. This is the narrative. And then if you're a black or minority woman, that's more points. If you're a minority woman whose gender is transsexual, which can be also women and men can each be transsexuals. And then if your gender is that it's a animal, so you're a transsexual female black cat. Whose real life is reincarnated from ancient Egypt. Now, these being oppressed add up, and your identity ranks very high on identity politics. So therefore, you demand inclusion in almost everything, and we have to celebrate the way you see your sexuality. Now, from the normal analysis that has gone on in psychiatry and psychology, that would be considered schizophrenia because you're existing in a self-constructed reality.
Right.
It has no relationship to real reality. It's just your made-up reality that you're living within. You know, it's like John Nash, the brilliant scientist who imagined he was living in this world of secret knowledge and secret agents, and none of it existed except in his mind.
Right.
Hey, that's schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, okay, so this gender performance and that your real identity is transgender and that that's all in your mind. Mm-hmm. Because it's in your mind and you affirm it, then everybody else has to celebrate that and accept that as real. Okay, so the psychiatric schizophrenics are running the asylum. And that's what it turns out to be. That's how it, but in the history of philosophy, it goes all the way back. I go back to the pre-Socratics. I start really with Immanuel Kant, who in the 1700s was a German political philosopher, a very deep philosopher. But he posited that all of our experience is through our senses. We experience reality through our senses.
Empirical.
It's all subjective. Because your senses are different than my senses. And we may see the color green differently. Or you may be colorblind and, you know, I see color. So we perceive reality. But Kant had this idea of a priori. In other words, it wasn't simply made up. In other words, there was a objective reality that informed whether your perception of reality was true or not true.
Okay, so a priori meaning before, so predecessory knowledge.
Yes, it's very similar to what Aristotle and Plato, especially Plato, writing about, you know, the ideals or the ideas. In other words, there is a structure. Another way of looking at it would be in, you know, from the biblical tradition and the Jewish Kabbalistic thinking, there's a logos. The Bible starts, the logos is the word, it's the logic, it's the rules that create this reality, which are not arbitrary. They are a set of rules, which means that, you know, if you drop a pin, it's going to fall to the floor. And then the rules of reality get complicated because relativity theory and quantum theory are constantly having to be revised as we learn more about reality. But the point is, for Kant, it is not arbitrary. It's not subjective. And so therefore, the laws which regulate how the world works and human behavior are also natural law and natural right. There are naturally right things and there's naturally wrong things. And Kant calls them categorical imperatives, which he tries to make almost as a logical definition so that, for instance, you can't say it is right to lie because that would undermine all rational conversation. You couldn't tell whether somebody is telling the truth or lying. So it is wrong to lie because that means that the fundamental basis of truth or conversation is undermined. So it's imperative that the rule as formulated as a moral principle be thou shalt not lie. Okay, and that's how Kant viewed the reality. But again, that's just the beginning.
I'll say a couple of things. Just so you started with talking about like the climate junk science narrative. And, you know, it's of their own admission that that was basically propaganda. You know, the Club of Rome wrote their document, Limits of Growth, in 1972, and that's where they declared that the enemy of humanity was man. This is why you are the carbon they want to reduce. We know that carbon dioxide is actually the life molecule. And the thing that I think anybody who took third grade science knows this, but if you needed evidence of that, what do they inject into a greenhouse to make it green, to make it grow? It's carbon dioxide. But in their 1992 document, the Global Reformation document, they said that they needed to create a common enemy in order to get people to rally behind. So, of course, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially they were admitting that people were not going to buy the junk science, but that this was a very important narrative for them to craft for their agenda, for their Malthusian purposes. And so they decided that, you know, man was the common enemy of humanity. And then I wanted to address what you were talking about with the, essentially I call it like the victimhood Olympics. You know, it's you get all these points for being. So I don't know how familiar you are with my personal story, but part of how I got into all of this was this whole victimhood Olympics, because I have a kind of unique birth story. So I'm hearing impaired, I'm visually impaired. You know, I had a lot of challenges from birth. And when 2020 hit, you know, and of course there was all the BLM riots, and what a lot of people were saying was I was their token, you know, like disabled female friend. And they were so disappointed in me because I really should be championing these, essentially this victimhood Olympics. And I should be, you know, cheering for these underdogs. And I remember just being so incredibly insulted. And just it was infuriating because, I mean, I've spent my entire life, you know, trying to overcome the challenges. I think we're all born with challenges, you know, some of them are more rare than others. But, you know, it's one of the guarantees in life, you know, we're going to deal with challenges, we're going to suffer, and we will die. You know, those are kind of things you can count on in life. I never saw it as something that I should be wearing as a banner. But I also, it's what really, I think I had always thought about kind of like virtue signaling as being very repulsive, but it really, it triggered me in such a way that I don't think I had really thought about why it bothered me so much. Intellectually, I understood why it bothered me, but I felt personally, you know, really angered by it. And I realized it's because most of my life, you know, whenever somebody wanted to use me as the example, they would virtue signal. But when it would actually serve me, they didn't. And I'll give just a really quick example. The very first time I ever asked for any kind of accommodation was when I was in college, because I had never had any kinds of, you know, accommodations for the visual, hearing impairments, the other challenges that I had. But this time I was in much bigger environments. You know, the teachers were constantly turning around. I couldn't read their lips. I learned how to speak by reading lips. So that was very challenging. I couldn't really hear them. They were far away. I couldn't see the board. And so I had learned through, there was another student in the class that she had a note taker. Now she had cerebral palsy. She was in a wheelchair and she was awesome. This is not a dig at her. She was brilliant and a total trooper, definitely an overcomer, but she didn't need a note taker. This was one of those things that they did really just, you know, to show that, like, if they had somebody who was carrying her books and pushing her wheelchair, those sort of things she needed. Those are the kinds of things that would have been very helpful for her, but note taker wasn't one of the things she needed. But they gave her a note taker, and I asked, and they said, "Why? You're doing fine." And I remember it was one of the first times where I really got very irate, and I said, "Well, what if I wanted to do great? Why fine? Okay." And so essentially they turned down my request, even though I knew I was legally entitled to have a note taker. And I realized it was because it didn't serve their virtue signaling purposes. So this is just to make things concrete for people. You know, I think people learn by proxy, so sharing my personal story. But that's really this whole, you know, it's absurd because the very people they're purporting to help are usually the people they end up hurting because it's all about the optics and the virtue signaling. It's not about actually helping the people they're purporting to want to help. And the other thing that you brought up, really, this whole idea of schizophrenia, this, you know, kind of reality that's within their own bubble. It does appear that a lot of these people are, they just have such a warped sense of the world, such a warped sense of reality. And those are the people who are running the show. And ironically, they're the people who have created the whole field of social science, which in my opinion, you know, not to say that there aren't good, decent people who are in it because they care about humans and want to help them. And some of them have done great things to help people. But a lot of it does seem like it's been for the purposes of social engineering and enslaving humanity. They want to control other people. And this comes out of their own perversion, their own psychoses. And it seems like the theme that really came up throughout the whole book is this kind of Gnostic worldview. It's this idea that, you know, they're upset with God. They feel that God's enslaved them, that God has withheld, you know, esoteric knowledge from them, and that they really have this ability to, through gnosis, they can become gods. And of course, those people who do that then should be the ones for whom controlling rights are reserved, and they can lord their brilliance over, you know, the rest of us peons.
Well, one of the key things you said was that, first of all, they start out with this whole victimhood idea, which is that it's up to them. First of all, they're mad. They're angry at God because of what you said, that we're going to die. Well, that's not fair. We shouldn't die. Okay. And that's wrong. And so they say, and then secondly, they say, well, you shouldn't be impaired. You shouldn't have come in with these problems. You should, it's not fair that you were born with those. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, it's not fair that, you know, you as a woman may not have the same advantages as a man. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you've got other qualities that a man doesn't have, which are equally dignified, but they don't see that. Right. They want the victimization implies that you're guilty because that happens, and therefore you have a responsibility to change it and fix it. Right. And the fundamental reality they don't accept is that life is not fair. In fact, John Rawls, as I point out, came up with the idea that justice is fairness. Well, justice is fairness, you wouldn't need two words. You need two words because the concept of justice is not necessarily fair. It's right. In other words, the way a criminal is treated should be different than the way someone who's law-abiding is treated. And that's not fair because they're not treated equally, but they don't deserve to be treated equally because one's committed crimes and the other has not.
Right.
But in this view of perfection that is projected is that there should not be these problems. We should all be equal. We should all be gifted. We should all be living forever. It should all be perfect. Mm-hmm. And I say it fundamentally comes out of the Garden of Eden story, which is that, you know, God withheld knowledge from us. And he said, don't eat this tree, because he was afraid we would become him or surpass him by learning secret knowledge that he withheld in creating this place in order that we suffer. And so therefore Satan comes along and says, if you eat this fruit, you won't suffer. We can make this perfect. God did, but we can perfect it. Okay. And so once you start down that path, you begin to introduce the idea that life can be transcended. It can be made perfect. We can be transhuman. We don't have to suffer human nature. We don't have to suffer the limitations that are, and the acceptance of those limitations require a concept of God, which I think is built into the logos. It's built into who we are. Mm-hmm. But Satan hates God. He hates that only God can create life. And it becomes a death cult.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of my book is to trace this through the evolution of the dark side of philosophy, which goes down the path of Marxism, and then neo-Marxism and Maoism, and ends up in postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
And that journey, Frankfurt School is part of this, takes it in a very bizarre direction. Because Marx fundamentally is dealing with resentment. He's saying that workers are being oppressed by those who have the capital. Their work is being exploited. They're no longer authentic. They're alienated from the fruits of their labor.
Right.
And so they're used as it were, as slaves, and they should rise up and eliminate capital. Well, again, this idea, first of all, didn't work. I expected there'd be revolutions in 1848. There were revolutions, but labor did not rise up and throw away capital. Capital adjusted and began to provide for workers, and it was beginning of labor unions and other sharing of the benefits of capital with those who produced it. So the fundamental nature of Marxism is a failed theory to begin with, but yet because it was aimed at destroying capitalism, which is productive, which is a method by which we can produce prosperity, these demons hating God had to destroy capitalism. And so what you find in the root of woke is a hatred of human beings, self-loathing, and a Malthusian desire that if we could just get rid of most of these people who are useless to us, this would be a fine place, because they don't have an idea of God. They don't have an idea of the dignity of life. They don't have an idea that this is a precious and unique experience that was never meant to be permanent.
Mm-hmm.
They have no concept that there could be anything spiritual beyond this. I mean, you get guys like this Noah Harari, who is, you know, a borderline insane. And mm-hmm. he starts saying, well, you know, you cut a human being open and you see the lungs and the heart and the bones, but you don't see human rights anywhere. So that's a fiction.
Right.
Just make that up because mm-hmm. it's not real. You can't see it. Well, you know, you can't see the subconscious either, but it keeps your heart beating at night when you're asleep. But it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Right. Right.
And so yeah. these are the fundamental mistakes. Mm-hmm. Yet communism is tremendously seductive because it tells people who resent their condition in life that they are the victims and they are right. And it's the other people who are oppressing them and they are evil and the enemy. And they have to be revolted against in order to create this utopia in which we can experience everyone being just fine and everything being just fair. And it all, but that is never going to happen here.
It means nowhere. So.
It's nowhere. Utopia in Greek means nowhere.
Yeah.
And that's what it is. And yet it's seductive.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody yeah. who's feeling resentment. Okay, so you had various impairments physically.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of being angry that you had them, resenting God that you had them, mm-hmm. you decided it was your obligation, it was your challenge to overcome them.
Mm-hmm.
And you sought to do that. You didn't feel sorry for yourself that you had to overcome them, that other mm-hmm. people didn't have these. You just said, this is my challenge and it's not going to defeat me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that immediately meant you were not a victim.
Right.
You were proactive. Mm-hmm. You took responsibility for the conditions you were given. Mm-hmm. You didn't question that it wasn't fair
mm-hmm.
because there is nothing fair about life.
No, definitely not fair.
It's not fair.
No.
Because we're each born to a particular set of parents.
Yep.
At a particular time, in a particular economic and social condition, at a particular period of human history.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you're born during World War II and you're living in a country that's being bombed, it's not fair.
No.
But you might get bombed to death. But it's not adjudicated in that wasn't fair, so it shouldn't have happened. Unless, of course, you are on the dark side of blaming God for creating this experience not to benefit you.
Right.
And if you want this experience to benefit you, you're going to get into your own psychosis and mm-hmm. demand that everybody accept whatever you say you are, regardless right. of how bizarre that may be.
Right. And
if you decide you want to be transgender and do a story time hour for children who have not reached puberty and you want to expose your genitals, you mm-hmm. ought to be in prison. But in this society, in this, you will be celebrated.
Yep. Yeah.
Because, you know, so again, the queering of the American child. Yes. And,
yep.
and James Lindsay's done some very, very good work at all of this.
Yeah, he has. And you incorporate, I mean, the amount of work you incorporate in this book is truly amazing. You incorporate a lot of his work. There's a lot of McGee, who I think you do a really great job. Hegel is so instrumental in all of this. I was going to say something before I got into this, just to comment on this notion of man and the, you know, the fact that man is mortal and the desire for transcendence. I think the juxtaposition is the people who seek, you know, eternal transcendence and recognize that, you know, the time here in the physical domain on Earth is finite. And, you know, they're looking to hopefully imprint something greater in the internal sphere versus the people who want to rule here on Earth and that they see, you know, that man could potentially be perfected. And it's these, you know, elite people who have the wisdom to be able to perfect man. And interestingly enough, the Illuminati, the initial name for them was the Perfectibilis, you know, because that's their belief system. And of course, it was those people and those philosophers and idealists who were very instrumental in influencing Hegel. You know, I would say Kant was an idealist for sure, but he wasn't necessarily a mystic. Whereas people like Fichte, who very much influenced Hegel, Fichte has a quote. I don't have it in front of me, but he actually talks about the purpose of education being to eradicate the free will of humanity. And these were the people who were really instrumental on Hegel. So when I was thinking about Hegel, you incorporate McGee's work, and I think McGee is really complicated for a lot of people. You do a really great job of kind of distilling it in a way that brings it very much to.
Yeah, that's McGee's book right there. That's on the Hegel. It's on the in the Hermetic tradition. First of all, understanding the Hermetic tradition is itself difficult, and because it demands studying of the Kabbalah. Now, the Kabbalah is perverted to be kind of a magic system, but if you study the original Kabbalah, it is a spiritual understanding that we are all, in a sense, experiencing God, and that we are, in a sense, not the identities that we have on Earth, which is just like an avatar. This is who we are right here.
Right.
But we have the capability of being a higher spiritual entity as we realize that there are God and is above us. I mean, the basic Kabbalah story in the tarot cards are that we all die in the sense that, and then we are reborn in a spiritual sense and going through childhood again in a spiritual sense, until we come to understanding the nature of the spirit of the world, which is to begin identifying with the will of God, identifying with seeing things transcendentally, seeing things as a spiritual purpose, in which we can then, it's a very complicated system. That's really the tree of life, which, which is the fundamental idea of a path towards which you ascend in a higher level to reach spirituality.
So you think the original Kabbalah was authentic? You think it was perverted or somehow distorted to create this mystical kind of black magic?
Yes.
Interesting.
And I think that McGee sees it the same way. In other words, if you go back to the original Hermetic writings, or if you go back to study some of the original Hermetic thinkers, they had a perception of the spirituality in everything. You know, Boehm, I write a lot about Boehm in here, who was an early theosophy. He was really he's very strange.
He was kind of like the, I don't know what you would call it, retroactive theosophist.
He played a very profound effect for Hegel. Hegel had studied him.
Yeah.
And Hegel understood that, this whole idea was, how do we reach this higher understanding of our existential existence, that we are, why are we here?
Right. That's
fundamental. Why are we here? Why do we exist? And Boehm had a mystical moment in which he perceived the spirituality of everything. In other words, he saw God in everything, which is one way of looking at matter, looking at our experience, but takes a lot to get to that perception correctly. And what Hegel took from it was that you could perfect human existence to become more godlike, more transhuman, and this is mystical through history and through the dialectical, which would be, his dialectical wasn't, neither Kant nor Hegel had a true dialectic. They had versions of the dialectic.
Right.
And Hegel's version was that through history, we evolve into higher and higher states. So in other words, from cavemen to today, it is not just our technology, but it is that we have become more transhuman. And what Hegel believes is that world historical figures like Napoleon push this, and it's always in the direction, like Kant, of experiencing an ultimately true freedom or reaching a perfection. And so the
Hegel said that true freedom could only be achieved through subservience to the state. He saw the state as being God.
He became a secular religion. Yes. And he believed that ultimately he set out the basis. I mean, Kant himself was the first to really envision a United Nations. He had this he had this idea that evolved. They both did. And they but Hegel defined it more as the bureaucrats. In other words, he felt that bureaucrats would be would rule according to the true principles of right and wrong and would make equitable and fair decisions for everybody. He never met a bureaucrat who was imposing his own little his or her petty ideas on everybody else and demanding rule books as to how we all live.
He hasn't been to any state capitals recently.
Right.
He
never sat in the House of Representatives to listen to the monarchy. So the point is that this view ultimately became, you know, Weber, Max Weber was probably one of the greatest writers on idealizing the bureaucracy. Woodrow Wilson was a student of Hegel. And so, and one of the great critics, I believe, of Hegel was Bertrand Russell, because Bertrand Russell.
I found that so interesting. I actually didn't remember that until I read your book. That's true. That is really interesting.
Yeah, Bertrand Russell is actually quite brilliant and had a very good perception. But what he wrote of Hegel, this was in Politics and Philosophy, his 1950 book on Popular Essays, which is a very good book. I mean, he said, they, the philosophers like Hegel, have professed to discover a formula of progress, showing that the world was gradually becoming more and more to their liking. That's the key point. The recipe for a philosophy of this type is simple. The philosopher first decides what are the features of the existing world that give him pleasure, and which are the features that give him pain. Then by a careful selection among the facts, he persuades himself that the universe is subject to a general law leading to increasing that amount of what he finds pleasant and decreasing what he finds unpleasant. Next, having formulated his law of progress, he turns on the public and says, it is fated that the world must develop as I say. Therefore, those who wish to be on the winning side, who do not want to wage a fruitless war against the inevitable, will join my party. Those who oppose him are condemned as unphilosophic, unscientific, out of date, while those who agree with him are assured of victory, since the universe is on their side. At the same time, the winning side, for reasons which remain somewhat obscure, is represented as the side of virtue. Well, that's where the woke go. They imagine that they can posit this set of values which are liberated, authentic. These are true values. And that we will get there. And it's really, you know, John Lennon. Imagine there was no God. Well, then we wouldn't have religious wars. Imagine there were no boundaries and nations wouldn't fight. Well, how about imagining there was no John Lennon to posit this nonsense? Because you can't imagine the world in which you live by the things that you like, which Hegel is taking to justify himself. Hegel's ultimate goal was to create a secular religion in the German Prussian state, which would be Deutschland über alles. This Prussian state would rule all because it would be the perfection. And if you weren't Prussian, you probably didn't qualify. And he liked Napoleon because Napoleon was a conqueror. He liked various of the German early kings and emperors. I remember Germany until about 1871 was a collection of small states. It was not unified as a state. It had these different states, Bohemia, et cetera, that were all independent. But you know, Russell felt that Hegel, in his earliest years, was attracted to this mysticism, that there was some kind of a force in history. There was this, you know, we could transcend, become better than human, which again is, we'll eat the fruit of the poison fruit, and we will learn what God did not allow, and that is God doomed us to be these fallen creatures and for some reason, that's how God created this place, and God messed up. But we'll eat this fruit. We'll know what God didn't want us to know, and we'll fix it. Okay, so, you know, and I also quote the work of Coughlin and Higgins quite. And I think they were both, both came from military intelligence and understood the psychological operation.
And dialectic is so instrumental in psychological operations. I actually interviewed somebody not too long ago who's in the Senate, and he talked about how Braver Angels, who's an offshoot of the Masons, came to them to do a whole seminar on using the dialectic for psychological warfare operations. And he was very disturbed by this, but he said that most of his peers, it went right over his head, over their heads, and they were not concerned at all. But I don't doubt it at all, because I've, through the studies, you see that when you talk about even, you know, through the culture and how you'd mentioned several instances, and I don't think you talked about it in the book, but certainly this is relevant to psychological warfare and military operations. The Tavistock Institute, you know, they created the Creel Commission, who was overseeing Wilson, and that was all about creating propaganda for to garner acquiescence from the British people and the American people for World War One. Then, of course, the music industry, they were very instrumental in influencing in the drug culture and for the purposes of, I think, dialectical operations, because they saw how if you create these polar opposites, then you can create hyper reactionaries. And, you know, their goal was to create, I think, violent reactionaries, because that would create, you know, chaos, which would be a breeding ground for usurpation power.
Well, I do talk about that in some of the other books I've written.
Okay.
And how these narratives are constructed, it fascinates me.
Yeah.
but I want to make two more points that this book makes. That the two major influences that crafted where we were in philosophy, I think, come based upon Gramsci, and I take Gramsci to be the root of Mao. Because Gramsci was this Italian communist between world wars, who was in prison, and he kept these notebooks. Now, if you read these notebooks, they're mostly dribble. And he's talking a lot about local Italian politics, which is insignificant. But what he comes to the conclusion of is that you don't attack capitalism, you attack the culture of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And the critical thing about human beings is culture. This is where Harari is, as he sees culture is the ultimate code of human beings, because culture defines these narratives we have about how we should live.
Right.
And so therefore, the it's a complete nutcase, and most of these guys are.
Uh-huh.
and they're hard to read, because they're creating their own languages, they're creating their own realities, and you've got to get into it. But the point of Gramsci was that we live in a capitalist society which has us believe in God, has us believe in subjugating sexual desires, working, the good that we should work, and that life is going to be hard. And he rebels against all of that. And he says that you've got to fundamentally attack the culture. Now, as this developed, the Frankfurt School, which is another group of communists, mostly Jews who came out of Nazi Germany about 1933, before Hitler really started killing Jews, although they could see it in the works, they came to the United States and they started destroying United States. They turned very destructive. These people are all very destructive.
Yes.
They want to destroy what exists to create their idea of the perfect. Yep. So when you get to Marcuse, for instance, they begin to read Freud into Marx on the idea that capitalism suppresses our sexual instincts, and therefore, to liberate human beings, we have to engage in uninhibited sex. And so if you read people like Adorno and Horkheimer, two of the original Frankfurt School, and their Dialectic of Enlightenment, they challenged the Enlightenment as being, you know, reason and principles of reason, which are like principles of work, they're discipline. And they actually spend a good deal of that book admiring Marquis de Sade,
mm-hmm.
and saying the Marquis de Sade's books, which are, if you've ever read them, they're first of all enormously boring, repetitive, and sadomasochistic.
Mm-hmm.
So that the sex that they propagate, it, which is largely group sex, yep. always has an abusive characteristic to it.
Yeah.
And that's their true enjoyment. It's sadistic, masochistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's certainly not an elevated idea of sex. It's very much sex that is very brutal, very animal-like, but they dignify it because yep. it's uninhibited. So mm-hmm. there's nothing you can imagine that you want to do that they rule out. Mm-hmm. It's a pleasure, whatever pleases you.
Right.
And Marcuse, by the time he became, you know, the darling of the new left during the 1968 anti-war movement, actually wrote a book called Eros and Civilization, in which he fully embraced Freud and said that we would only become authenticated when we indulged in uninhibited sex, which mm-hmm. means no God, no marriage, no children. There's Marcuse with his cigar.
Yep.
And he really didn't become famous until he was older.
Yeah.
He got celebrated because largely that book, I remember when I was at Harvard, that book was everywhere in a paperback edition and everybody was reading it. And the sexual revolution in 1960, about 1968, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll swept the universities.
Mm-hmm.
Because it gave license to uninhibited sex, uninhibited indulgence in drugs,
mm-hmm.
This whole idea in music, which reflected it, so that they were seeking a transformational experience. This was somehow or other going to elevate you into a new level.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it elevated them into drug addiction and to sex addiction and not having families and not having children and deciding that they were going to be divorced and everything else. And you got mm-hmm. another messed up generation. That's the book.
Right. Yeah.
But it was extremely popular.
Yes.
And this is a carrying on of Gramsci, so that once Mao gets a hold of the idea, Mao decides he can propagate his set of values,
yep.
which are to destroy Confucianism, Taoism, to go against all the traditions in China.
Yes.
To throw them out with this little red book of his sayings. And the Red Guard went around China, taking anyone who was a doctor, a philosopher, a person who was teaching in universities, anyone who was doing something mature and valuable with traditional values.
Right. And had an understanding of history. Yeah. Of the old ways. Yeah.
They destroyed libraries, they destroyed temples, and they destroyed everything tore
down. The BLM destroying the statues, that was a very Maoist tactic, yeah.
Very Maoist tactic. Erase history and destroy, start over again. Well, all these things resulted, this and Stalin, all these, when communism succeeds, it kills millions of people.
Yes.
And establishes a totalitarian system because, as Russell understood, Bertrand Russell, it doesn't permit to be argued with, or if you see it differently, you're reactionary because mm-hmm. you haven't, you know. So John Lennon again, you know, imagine all this, and you know, you may say we're dreamers, but there's millions of us. Why don't you come join us?
Mm-hmm.
See things like we see, and then you'll understand why we're smoking drugs and smoking marijuana and taking every drug in the face of the earth we can find and mm-hmm. having sex all day long. And that's what we want the university to be. And yes. so, and therefore, we'll denounce as, you know, reactionary and warmongering and colonialist anyone who has traditional values. And if you believe in God, you're dangerous because you want us to adopt these old ideas, which are just designed to imprison us in a capitalistic mm-hmm. work structure in which we die and are exploited.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time you get there, the only next place it's got to go is postmodernism.
Right.
We have another group of French nutcases, or perhaps my least favorite coffee shop, you know, Sartre intellectuals.
Yes.
They sit around in their existentialism and they decide, my favorite of them is Baudrillard, appears in the Matrix movies. His book on simulacrum and simulations is because what Baudrillard says, he has a quotation from Ecclesiastics, and it, which basically says that the simulacra, it's not in Ecclesiastics.
Yeah.
He says the simulation is what's true.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, everything's a word game.
Right.
Everything is a language configuration. In other words, okay, what was the Iraq War about? He wrote a book during the first Iraq War in 1991 saying the Iraq War didn't happen. Well, he knew it happened. But what he meant was the narratives about it were not true.
Right.
We didn't get rid of Saddam Hussein.
Right.
You know, things that we said we were there to do, Kuwait just went about the same. The armies withdrew. So all the things we said we were going to accomplish, we didn't accomplish. So Baudrillard would influence the Matrix movies because he said our experience of this reality is like a matrix.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the Plato cave analogy, the images that are projected on the wall by people behind us with torches. That's the reality. He said there is nothing beyond the simulacrum. He was a nihilist. He said nothing exists. Like mm-hmm. Wittgenstein, who also got into language games and to conceived of everything. And I've read a lot of Wittgenstein over the years. It is fascinating,
mm-hmm.
but it's bizarre because everything is a created reality.
Right.
It's a Truman Show.
Yeah, it's a Truman Show.
And it justifies Truman Shows in existence. Since everything's a simulacrum, why can't you make up your own narratives and propagate mm-hmm. them?
Yeah.
So therefore, when the left says that it's all racist, and it's racist to have voter IDs, they don't realize that probably every minority in America is already walking around with identification.
Right.
It's hard to get because they probably can't drive a car without identification.
So right.
Everybody's got identification. But yet,
or they wouldn't have gotten into this country without some sort of identification, right?
And here they'll get identification of one kind or another. But yes. The point is, it's not that it's true that it's right. racist, but in their minds, in the perfect world, you wouldn't require minorities to be identified.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't require anybody to be identified because you're self-identifying.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be stuck with a government identification. So therefore, you're self-identify. And the idea of voting, we don't need no stinking voting. What we're going to do is we're going to have transformational agreement, which is mm-hmm. Habermas calls this social discourse.
Mm-hmm.
We argue about things and then the group consensus of what's right becomes true. And if we all decide that, you know, the gender is not sex, then people who think that sexual organs determine sex, well, they just don't understand the higher perception of the reality in which we live. So therefore, we scream at them. We can't debate them. We just scream at them.
Somehow that's going to work. We'll just convince them. Yeah. Convince them that our insanity is actually legitimate. I have a couple of questions for you. One of them is you were talking about, like the Lenin, imagine, imagine Lenin, all the world, imagine all the people, right? Anybody who's ever done one of these workshops knows that they play that song every time you enter, every time you leave. That is a brainwashing tactic. It is intentional to create a communist mindset. But here, what I'm kind of wondering is, with you go through all of these philosophers, and this is something I've kind of grappled with myself, because I do think some are genuinely sorting through ideas. When you look at someone like Kant, I think a lot of people, they're very quick, and this is people who haven't read a lot of philosophy typically, they're very quick to judge them as being disingenuous or hypocritical, because a lot of times they do contradict themselves. But if you've read enough philosophy, oftentimes these are people who are not always the most stable, but they're really sorting through things. And they sort through pretty complex ideas. Somebody like Kant, I think, really was sorting through these ideas. And, you know, sometimes his ideas would change and they would kind of contradict some of his earlier works. But then you have, I think, especially in late, but I don't think this is just true of modernity, because you had these kind of power structures from really the inception of man. I think sometimes they're controlled, and, you know, it's for the purposes of, you know, abetting an agenda. And they know that the influence of these ideas on the masses will be very powerful in creating narratives, in creating essentially mind control. And so in particular, we could take something like the sexual revolution, you know, and you were talking about how a lot of it is, you know, very, not just degenerative, but it's really, the word that comes to my mind is traumatic. That's why it's destabilizing to the society, because now you're creating people who are essentially traumatized. And of course, they justify their trauma, you know, by justifying the action that this is the better way. And this is the way we must, you know, live life, because this is truly liberating and truly freeing. But really, they're traumatized. And trauma is, you know, a breeding ground for mind control, as we know from all of we know this from MK Ultra experiments, right? So it's a very long-winded way of asking, how much do you think these thinkers are privy to that? How much do you think they're indoctrinated or brainwashed by it? Do you think it's a mixture of the two?
Well, I think philosophy in general starts out with some very serious questions, and questions which are fundamental to the human experience. Mm-hmm. And the fundamental question is, why are we here and what is this about? In fact, where is here?
Yes.
And who are we?
Yes.
So there's some very fundamental questions here that we're born and we didn't get a manual and we don't have these answers programmed into us. We just show
up. That's about where existentialism ends in its validity. Those questions are very valid.
And there have been some brilliant solutions to it. Mm-hmm. But I think this one solution, this one brand of philosophy, which goes to transhumanism, mm-hmm. which has its theme that we can be perfective, has a sub-theme that what is traditional has to be destroyed in order to get to this transcendent experience.
Right.
And so therefore, this whole line that we're talking about of philosophy is fundamentally destructive, and it's conducive to narratives and memes and ways of thought and arguments that ultimately are designed to imprison us. I think the idea that these, to whomever, you know, Marcuse's idea of perfection is not a life I'd want to live. It's a life in which, you know, you don't necessarily even know who your sexual partners are because you don't spend enough time with them.
Right.
And it may be different tomorrow. And you're in polymorphy.
You've probably taken too many drugs to know who they were if you were,
Or to remember.
To remember, exactly.
Or even to remember who you are.
Right.
Okay, well, that's not a particularly productive way to live. It's not a particularly fulfilling experience. And, you know, you can't drill a hole in your boat because you want to see the fish and expect the boat to stay afloat. It's going to sink. Now, you may have wanted that to work, but there are fundamental laws about how this place works. And so, therefore, there are lines of thinking philosophically that are much more productive. Now, one of the new challenges, and I think it's imperative for philosophy to address some of these questions. And this is a trilogy. The first book I wrote was on the energy, global warming, and climate change, in which my point was that, you know, they lie. This book is all basically a science lie. Mm-hmm. And this book is about why it's a lie, because they do not believe there's a standard of truth.
Right.
And that's the world in which they live.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The third book is going to be about transhumanism, perpetual life extension, and artificial intelligence.
Right.
And what I'm going to demonstrate there, what is that where they're going is trying to perfect human beings.
Yep.
Now, the other line of philosophy, which I think will have to be taken when we have a more complete understanding of things like fully fractal math, we understand nonlinear math, when we understand relativity theory and quantum physics, is that everything does reduce to energy.
Yeah.
And it is, in a sense, a spiritual, we perceive it as real. We perceive it as material, but on another level, it's not material at all.
Mm-hmm.
But yet it works, and it's not arbitrary.
Right.
And at each level you go down, there's certain laws that are operative.
I think the photons are the most concrete example we have indicating this, right? Where the where they kind of mirror each other, what one photon does, the other reacts in equal measure. And then also the experiments they've done with the, in Hermeticism, in the principles of Hermeticism, I'm referencing more of the black magic variation, which is what a lot of these forerunners of the field of psychology were really trying to harness. But there are experiments that have been conducted that prove that there is power of, just mental manipulation of matter.
Well, the first of all, biblically, mm-hmm. There's two things in the Bible is very important. It starts out, in the beginning there was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. Now the importance of that is in the beginning was the Word. In other words, logos.
Mm-hmm.
Logos, structure, logic, rules were first.
Mm-hmm.
And that was with God, and then the logos was God. So in other words, and then the second thing is God begins by creating light. Let there be light is the first act of creation, which is, in a sense, a spiritual manifestation producing energy.
Mm-hmm. And
it produces light.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not out of the darkness. It produces light. Okay, those are fundamental statements, and they are fundamental, yes. I mean, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That's a progression. NRK in Greek was the Logos. And mm-hmm. Logos was with God, and then the Word was God. Okay, so that progression puts the Logos
mm-hmm.
at the heart of who God is.
Sure.
Okay, and it puts the spiritual begets the physical. So yes, I mean there are connections between human beings. They've looked at monkeys in South Sea Islands that the monkeys have no way of communicating with each other.
Right.
One monkey decides there's a new way to crack a shell open in a rock. And before the end of a certain period of time, all the monkeys are doing that on all the islands.
Right.
Or that someone comes up with an idea. This was part of the problem in the Manhattan Project. Once it was demonstrated that you could split the atom.
Mm-hmm.
Fermi, many of them, Einstein, the whole group of them realized immediately that the E equals MC squared was a formula for transforming matter into a phenomenal amount of energy.
Mm-hmm.
It could be done. The question was mechanically, how could it be done? But that idea propagated instantly in a dozen minds that were not connected by anything in space and time. The idea propagated.
Right.
Okay, so the way the world truly works is difficult to understand. Now, that's a philosophic set of questions that are going to be enduring.
Yeah.
But the point is the direction that Hegel took Kant
mm-hmm.
is this negative direction.
Yep.
Because Hegel, he glorified war. He glorified, this
conflict.
Prussian idea of obedience and structure. He went down this path of the mystical and mm-hmm. saying, we could posit this and that history was going to produce, had a law within it that was going to produce perfection, that we all had to get on the side of that or we were going to be losers.
Mm-hmm.
And so those are a very destructive set of ideas
that
are still working itself out right now in the what we see as the woke. Now, the problem with this, and the reason it can be defeated, it will be defeated,
mm-hmm.
is that the woke produce ideas that don't work. Okay, mm-hmm. so you can't drill a hole in the bottom of the boat and see the fish. You'll be with the fish.
Unless you want it to sink, yeah.
You want to be with the fish. Okay, so you can't have electric vehicles unless you do a lot to produce the electric vehicles and to make it work.
Yep.
Okay, so we don't have charging stations. We don't have electric grid set up for it. Use too much hydrocarbon fuels. And besides, hydrocarbon fuels aren't fossil fuels. So the ideas that the left produces mm-hmm. are dysfunctional right. because their philosophy is dysfunctional.
Yeah.
And schizophrenics schizophrenics running the asylum, you know, one flew over the cuckoo nest. It all turns out the psychotics are really the brilliant ones. Yeah, well, that's not the case. The psychotics are psychotic because they can't function.
Yeah.
You know, they self-destruct. You know, they poke pencils in their ear. You know, bad idea. They do things that are destructive.
Yeah.
And you don't want to have a group of, you know, psychotics running the world.
No.
You get Hitlers from that. You get people who are mentally disturbed.
Yes.
Okay. And so this process of there is a right, there is a logos, there are rules, is very hard for human beings to accept.
Mm-hmm.
And the devil says, well, I don't like those rules because I didn't make them. Why did God get to make those rules? There's resentment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Marx was not an atheist, a pure atheist. Marx knew the God, he hated God.
He wrote odes to Satan, literally. You have a couple of them in here, actually.
Oh, yes. Through that whole exercise.
With Umbrandt and Ken Gore. Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, Bakunin, who's another nutcase, hated God. And there were many of these. And all the way to Saul Alinsky, who dedicates, you know, Rules for Radicals, which he wrote in the 70s, to Lucifer.
Michael Walsh doesn't agree with us on that. Michael Walsh, you have him. I know him from California, but I've had a discussion with him. He doesn't agree that, you know, that was a tribute to Lucifer. I need to ask him to expound on that, but it seems like it is. I don't know.
Well, he says it's to Lucifer.
Yeah.
Who dared to rebel and was granted a kingdom. Now, who else could it be?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's Lucifer.
Yeah.
And if he wants to change it, it's because he doesn't like he likes Alinsky and he doesn't like that Alinsky identified with Satan. Alinsky identified with Satan.
Yeah.
Alinsky gave interviews saying he would be happier in hell than in heaven.
Yep.
It was more like him to be in hell than to be in heaven.
Yeah, because that it was more of his people, right?
And more of who he was.
Mm-hmm.
Because he hated logos.
Yeah.
That's fundamental to Satan, is the hatred of logos, the hatred of something that is greater than yourself,
mm-hmm.
of which you are a part of, which is the structure of who you are, and you didn't will that structure.
Right.
And that structure does not necessarily benefit you.
Right.
It may not be fair. It may not be pleasant. You know, it's not, you know, if you're a child and done nothing and they're, yeah, the you know, Genghis Khan comes through your village, it's not fair.
Right.
But it's what's happening. It is, and it is part of the logos in terms of how human beings behave. And if you want to glorify war, which Hegel does,
yep,
you are going to, you know, breed a certain consequence. We do not praise the peacemakers. We praise, and you know, again, a lot of, when you go back to the biblical structure of a lot of these ideas in the Bible and Jesus Christ, in terms of the reformation of some of these ideas, was encouraging people to accept the logos and to live on the side that the logos dictated would be productive. In other words, sex is fundamentally about procreation.
Mm-hmm.
And when it becomes disassociated with procreation and starts, you know, the right of a woman to choose, you suddenly get into abortion. You start killing babies.
Yep.
You know, chopping them up in pieces within wombs and selling their body parts.
Yep.
Well, that's not productive. That's drilling a hole in the bottom of a boat to see the fish. It's going to sink. And there are consequences even to the woman of killing a child. There are spiritual consequences. There are psychological effects of this. It's not an inconsequential act. It's not like changing your clothes. It's not like combing your hair. It is fundamentally psychically disturbing.
Yes.
And because there is a spiritual reality, and you can't deny or ignore the spiritual reality that exists. Mm-hmm. And as such, you know, even God saying at the beginning there was the Word.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's the acknowledgement of a structure mm-hmm. which somehow exists. And so was there another place where that structure doesn't exist? What, you know, I doubt it. I think this is it.
Yeah.
And where is this? Well, we don't know, quite frankly. It may all be in the mind of God. And some of the pre-Socratics contemplated that.
Yeah, they did.
But it doesn't mean that it's the Matrix movies where this is what Baudrillard objected to, where there's a group who perceive the real reality.
Mm-hmm.
All these other people are.
Yeah, asleep. Didn't he say like if he had really written it, you wouldn't be able to escape? Like the.
You wouldn't be able to escape because that's all there is.
Yeah,
all there is. He rejected the movies. He didn't like them. He wouldn't work with them. He thought they didn't understand what he was saying.
Yeah,
he was a nihilist.
Yeah,
he said there is nothing else except for the word game, except for how you constructed it, which you know then justifies all the people in World War II you were talking about, including Edward Bernays, whom I knew.
Yeah. Did you?
I got to know Edward Bernays very well when I was at Harvard and before then.
Wow.
Spent time with him, and he understood. He was part of that group.
Yeah.
And he understood the construction of narratives to influence behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And when they began going down that route of psychology, then the Maoists got equipped with some very powerful psychological tools
mm-hmm.
which they branded into the dialectic in order to be able to manipulate people to subject themselves to their control, the control of the people in charge of the means.
Yeah.
And that's what we are currently living. There's Edward Bernays.
And his nephew is the founder of our modern day propaganda machine, which I call Netflix, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a lot of time together. And we talked about a lot of these deep things at that time when I was yet in college
mm-hmm.
when I first met him.
Do you think he, knowing since you knew him back then, what do you think he thought of the ideas and the way that they were being utilized and what that would mean for the future?
Well, Bernays, Well, Bernays, there's two things about Bernays. One is he reflected a lot about what Russell said. In other words, he was willing to work to construct the propaganda that got America into World War I
mm-hmm.
because he felt that the Germans had to be defeated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it was important to defeat Nazi Germany also. I mean, Goebbels and wanted Bernays, we talked about this, to come back to Germany to help him create the Nazi state. Bernays was a Jew. He wasn't going to do it. But Bernays knew he used his book Propaganda that Bernays wrote in 1933. At that time, propaganda did not have a negative connotation. It just meant the construction of a set of ideas. Well, what Bernays discovered was that these word games, these constructions of ideas, these memes, you know, the packaging of sexes. Not, gender's not sex. The packaging of that idea, if done in a certain way, is very powerful. Now, Bernays understood it could be used for good or for bad.
Right.
And Bernays always assumed that the things he was fighting, and of course he had an argument about Germany, because he would argue that what Germany was in the First World War was mm-hmm. leading, was the, you know, the father of the child that became Hitler. That these tendencies were in the German character mm-hmm. and that he was concerned as a Jew that, you know, this was going to be not turn out particularly well for Jews. And he understood anti-Semitism as one of the key elements in German society that had been there for a long time. The Jews got thrown out of Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess many centuries earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But his genius was to understand the importance of word constructions
mm-hmm.
that can be formulated in the dialectic
Yes.
It becomes so seductive.
Yep.
Okay, but that technique can be used for evil as easily as it can be used for good. In fact, it's probably more conducive to be used for evil because you're no longer bound by the narratives you create having to be true.
Right.
They just have to be seductive.
Right.
Tell people you can be whatever you want in sex. Well, mm-hmm. a lot of people are confused, especially in puberty and coming out of puberty, about what their sexual orientation really is. And mm-hmm. for someone who is confused, they're vulnerable to these mm-hmm. kinds of memes, these mm-hmm. kinds of language games, these kinds of realities which they want to live.
Right.
You know, the condition of a psychological disease, mm-hmm. beings are very vulnerable to.
Sure. You know,
it, in reaction to all kinds of things that go on in life, they can be developed either chemically, or they can be developed because of certain experiences.
Mm-hmm.
It can be, you know, malwiring in the brain, whatever, any number of reasons. But
sure.
human beings, as motivated by thought, are subject to being wired incorrectly.
Yes.
And malware mm-hmm. of the brain.
They did that whole study with the false memories, where they can actually create false memories.
And so once you play with these techniques, you're learning more about human psychology.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the fundamental is you have to have a moral compass.
Right.
And if the moral compass isn't founded on God or the logos mm-hmm. or natural law, natural right,
mm-hmm.
then you are edging into a satanic world of hatred of God, hatred of these rules, hatred that it has to be a structure that you didn't create, hatred that you don't know where you are, hatred that you're not going to live forever, hatred that you have to sleep, or that you have to eat, or you have to suffer, or you have to grow old.
Man is free and everywhere he's in chains, and Sartre, man is hurled into the world, and thus having been hurled, he's responsible for everything he does. And Heidegger had a similar one with the thrownness. I forgot how you say it in German, but you know, this idea, it's a similar idea that you're thrown into the world and we didn't ask to be here. And so then therefore we're doomed.
Well, what many of these things are a misunderstanding of the fact that it was necessary that we be here. In mm-hmm. other words, it's part of the structure of logos. In other words, this had to develop.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning, the beginning included the end.
It's, mm-hmm.
and it had a certain logic to it, or a certain logos to it. But the being in itself, and the, you know,
Dasein, being there,
yes, yep. The being in the moment, the being there and creating a authentic reality of being there. Heidegger is very difficult to read.
Yes,
and also.
I wrote my thesis on Heidegger, so I did a lot of that reading. Yeah,
and became
and he's also creating his own language. I mean, it's already translated from German, which I don't speak, but then he really did create so much of his own jargon.
Well, so did Kant, so did Hegel. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And in German, it's actually easier to understand because they have these compound words that express the
like Abheben is such an oxymoronic word, this idea to lift up and preserve while simultaneously canceling and tearing down. I'll let you finish, but then I do want to discuss that. But yeah,
well, let's discuss it now. I mean, Abheben is the two concepts together.
Mm-hmm.
So it is basically that you have to destroy in order to create.
Yeah.
In other words, it's in German, it means both.
Mm-hmm, right.
But it has the connotation of more emerge, like that arrow. It's you emerge mm-hmm. out of this destruction with a higher idea. That's the synthesis.
Right.
It's almost like a dialectical word itself.
Yeah.
But it is fundamental to the Hegelian dialectic, because in terms of the thesis, what it is you're experiencing, and the antithesis, kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah, that was actually Fichte's interpretation of Kant's dialectic. As Hegel, the translation would be more abstract negative, upheaving, sublation, and then concrete. So he saw it as like the, which I, you know, is similar to synthesis, but it's really the concretization of the ideas that come together.
Hegel's idea of dialectic is actually fuzzy. And he uses it in several different contexts.
Don't tell him that, but it's not precise.
And that it has these different connotations when you really get to analyze it.
Yeah.
But it is always a taking A and B, which B is acting to destroy A, and out of that act of destruction is birthed a new idea.
Right.
And they believe that new idea will be superior to the previous ideas. That's the advancement in history.
Right.
Okay, so fundamental to all these thinkers is to destroy.
Yes.
And it's why they become ultimately depopulationists.
Yep.
Why they become anti-human. Mm-hmm. They really disdain human beings, and they, as such, disdain themselves. I mean, when you look at the climate movement, we exhale carbon dioxide.
Right.
So if you have to kill cows because they fart methane, well, you have to kill human beings because we exhale carbon dioxide.
Right.
And so therefore, we are in the Anthropocene, which is we are going to be the cause of our own destruction.
Right.
Unless, of course, we do the favor for those who are going to be transhuman of just euthanizing ourselves and save them the trouble.
Right.
Since we're worthless anyway. And since our existence is meaningless and there's no necessarily thereafter, why bother with all this anyway?
Yeah.
It's, so, you know, it's fundamentally, these ideas are very destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And they are subtly destructive because they are seductive in their saying to you, you can be, you know, like John Lennon's song, which is so filled with this. You can be one of the dreamers. You can be one of the you know, the oligarchs who live. You can be a Bill Gates. Now, you may have to kill a bunch of people to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You can still be the Bill Gates. You can be the Klaus Schwab. You know, forget about that his father was a Nazi producing war materials.
Right.
But he was raised
Edelweiss.
Tutored by Henry Kissinger.
Yep.
Another globalist. That he was, you know, brought into these trilateral groups and other groups who were trying to architect a new world order.
Yes.
Okay, so this whole idea of, you know, this new world order, it's on the dollar, Novus Ordo Seculorum, new order of the ages, is a fundamental concept that also in the Garden of Eden story, that we are not in perfection, but we are meant to create perfection. And to get there, we have to be transhuman. So we have to be like Nietzsche said, who is another psychiatric nutcase.
Yes.
Said, you know, we've got to get beyond good and evil.
Right.
We've got to transcend.
Ubermensch.
Ubermensch. Yep. We have to be superhuman.
Yep.
We have to become a different, or the current idea that Elon Musk has, that we can become transgender by merging ourselves with machines and computers, that we can become computers. So we just implant enough chips in our brains.
Right.
We begin thinking like a chip, or that maybe Bill Gates thinks that his ultimate form of living forever is to become a computer code.
A cyborg.
He'll exist as a computer code.
Right.
Which is the real reality, is computer code. I mean, and those branches of ideas, you have to go back to the fundamental rule. Does it work or doesn't it work? Does the boat float or does it sink?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this a productive idea or negative idea? What are the consequences of this idea? And the idea that we can create these memes and that we can shape behavior, that we can have information, disinformation, and misinformation, and we can dictate which is which. You know, so a much superior idea was, since we can't for sure know what was true, because there may be another way of understanding things that's superior.
Mm-hmm.
We have to keep everything provisional, which means that it needs to be debated, because somebody could come up with a better idea, like, you know, Copernicus, that you know, we aren't really, the sun is really not revolving around us. you know, and so therefore the whole world vision has to be changed.
Right.
You know, so this is, you know, coming and going of paradigms, which Thomas Kuhn brilliantly elucidated.
Yeah.
Is fundamental to the human condition.
Yep.
And the idea that we were never here to be perfected here is a very difficult idea for human beings to accept. That there are limitations to this experience, that it was not meant to be successful. Because in the end, we, no matter what we do, nobody gets out of here alive.
Right. Unless you become one of the cyborgs and the transhuman and posthuman crowd.
Yeah, well,
and
good.
They do a handbook now on posthumanism, so that is where they're going.
That's where they're going.
That is where they're going. I wanted to ask you about, so very relevant to the dialectic, you talk a lot about the Enlightenment, and I'm seeing kind of a movement, you know, some of these ideas that people, proponents of the Frankfurt School talk about where, you know, they dispute the Enlightenment. They have kind of a similar reason. So they want to negate the Enlightenment because, you know, they basically destroying any trust in reason and science, abolishing religion and all belief in God, and dismissing psychoanalytic theories that induce oppressed people to escape into a fantasy, salvation, hopes, and beliefs. And of course, you know, they need to destroy capitalism itself. But what I'm seeing actually now is a rise from the right, particularly the religious right, that is also aiming at, it's kind of, it seemed very dialectical because they're making the same kind of claims that the Enlightenment is the reason why we are here today. And they say it in a negative way. You know, it's the roots of liberalism that have led to the destruction of morality and the destruction of culture. And so therefore we need to destroy that. And it's, you know, of course it's not quite the same as the Frankfurt School notion of refuting the Enlightenment, but it is, I think the results are very similar, and I'm not so sure that it's organic. I'm not saying that everybody who subscribes to this worldview is inauthentic or doesn't genuinely believe that, but I do think that there's an intentional dialectical movement because the left has been so successful in trying to eviscerate Western culture, Western civilization, potentially trying to attack not just the Constitution, but the Bill of Rights, because that's founded on this notion of being endowed with inalienable rights from our creator. And that's a very unique concept to be codified in documents. Really there's no other document like it around the world. And I think that they want to fundamentally eradicate that and eviscerate it, which will bring me to my next question actually also about like why they target Western civilization so much. Cause you had brought up, Mao of course was trying to destroy ancient civilizations like Taoism and Confucianism. And, you know, interestingly enough, people might think that they're so, juxtaposed to traditional Western founding beliefs, but there's actually, I think, more similarity than not. I think that there's more similarity to each other than there is to this modern, postmodern type of worldview. So I guess, yeah, my question is just how do you see that playing out? Do you think that, they will be successful? Do you think there's any threat in that?
Well, the attack on Enlightenment, the left attacked Enlightenment. Let's take Adorno and Horkheimer. You had this whole dialectic of Enlightenment.
Yep.
They both felt that Enlightenment or this pursuit of reason and science was what culminated in the Nazi movement.
Mm-hmm,
so this was a rational, development of engineering, development of weaponry, development of means of destruction. And if that was the advances in science, including the atomic bomb, then the Enlightenment ought to be thrown away. Mm-hmm. And besides, they didn't want to be ruled by rules of anything like science. They wanted to be able to kind of magically
construct their own reality and their own rules.
Reality and their own rules. And that's where the this mystical element comes in of Hegel and of this entire movement. It's fundamentally a mystical movement. Mm-hmm. It becomes a secular religion. It gets rid of God, but it's mystical. Mm-hmm. And the head of it is...
Well, it gets rid of the traditional biblical God. I think they have their own version of God. You know, Hegelian God is definitely the state, but...
It's always secular.
Yeah.
It's always that there is some ability to perfect here on earth.
Yeah.
We don't need sky fairies in order to be able to perfect the world.
Right.
You know, so these are all just made up mythical ideas. And if you're a Christian and they amuse you, go ahead, but they're not, they have no basis in reality of any kind. Well, they may be the core of reality. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the, this whole current debate on enlightenment, mm-hmm. I think that there's also
You're seeing that as well, correct?
Oh yes, but okay. part of the debate with C.S. Lewis, and I talk about that with the scientism.
Yep.
In other words, where you can get people who are recognize the power of science, and so therefore they falsify the science, mm-hmm. or they use the science to,
or they mystify science.
They produce mRNA and they tell you that it's going to cure, it's a vaccine and it's going to cure epidemics and cure the virus. Well, first of all, I'm not even sure there are epidemics. An epidemic has got to be, first of all, novel. It's got to be, people are not already exposed to it, so the immune system is vulnerable to it.
Right.
It's got to be virulent and mm-hmm. it's got to kill massive numbers of people. Well, there has never been a virus or a disease that's killed everybody, as evidenced by the fact that we're still here.
Correct. So I concur.
So there's never been a pandemic then since. And if there are no novel diseases, but always a certain number of people are immune to them for whatever reason.
Right.
And those are the ones who are likely to survive. And the next mm-hmm. part about these diseases is they wear themselves out because they have mm-hmm. to kill the host in order to live. Well, that's a destructive design.
It's like drilling the hole in the bottom of the ship. Yeah. It's
a bad idea.
Yeah.
And there are good ideas and there's bad ideas.
Parasites are much smarter. You know, they weaken their host, but they keep their host going. They don't kill their host. Yeah.
A host eventually dies, though, is the problem. But they do part ways before it's completely dead.
Yeah.
Viruses tend to stay until it's completely dead. Then the virus dies.
Right.
That's an even worse design.
Yes.
Okay. And so therefore, they're not designed to be effective. Right. They're not designed to succeed. Yeah. And the idea of scientism, which is using science to perpetuate an idea that is false, mm-hmm. is part of the artifacts that come out of the Enlightenment, in which we honor people who pursue scientific work, mm-hmm. not realizing that it too can be fraudulent.
Sure.
What we're realizing now is a lot of science can be fraudulent and it becomes politicized so that only if you agree with the current government meme or the current university meme, if you're not, you know, if you don't worship Marcuse, you mm-hmm. criticize, use the wrong pronouns, you could lose your faculty position.
Right.
And that for which you've worked years to obtain and perfect, and you're now suddenly unemployable because you're done. Okay.
Repressive tolerance in effect. Yes.
So on the right, there's become a suspicion of the Enlightenment thinking. And it's also partly influenced by the enormous desire to not offend the left. You know, mm-hmm. people want to be virtue signaling to the left. You don't want to be called a racist. You don't want to be called, you know, a sexist. You don't want to be portrayed as a evil person because you believe in God or because you value marriage or you think there's sanctity in a woman's being able to create life, you know, to bear a child. Mm-hmm. These are issues that, you know, you don't want to be stigmatized because you dare to believe in such a traditional idea. So I find on the right, until the left gets to the point where they're getting now, where it's absolute madness,
mm-hmm.
What they want to produce. The fruit of the tree is absolute. It doesn't work. It's destructive. So, you know, in Germany right now, is deindustrializing because they closed down their nuclear plants.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's a bad idea. What the next thing they're going to do is chopping down trees to stay warm in winter. And we're using more coal now than we've ever used worldwide. We're producing more carbon dioxide than we've ever produced. And by the way, it's probably a good thing because the earth is greener.
Yes.
We have more food. Right. But, you know, the idea that we need to kill billions of people in order to survive and, you know, we've got to destroy humanity in order to save humanity is another insane idea.
It's like we have to have war so we can have peace.
Right. And that's insane.
Yes.
What we have is war. And then we bomb out Germany and we bomb out all of Europe. We let, you know, Curtis LeMay free with firebombing everything in the world and then dropping nuclear weapons. It has to be rebuilt. And now we're talking about doing it all over again. Try to get NATO into Ukraine, which Putin says will lead to nuclear war, and it probably will. But yet the demons in the State Department obsessed with this idea, except that Victoria Nuland finally resigned, and maybe that'll make some minimal difference. But the point is that our foreign policy, our government policy, following this, we're letting people out of the prisons. You know, they're the prosecutors are the ones who are the criminals. The justice is politically administered. People are going to get sick of this, and their children taught in school that they ought to question their sexuality when they don't even know what sexuality is.
Yeah.
You know, and mothers did not raise these children to be made into perverts. And the mothers aren't going to put up with it. No. And when they finally realize what's being taught to these kids, they're going to tear down the schools. And that's not a bad idea.
No.
And so
when you understand the history of the schools,
John Dewey and everything else. I mean, the whole thing is the human beings, the fundamental condition of human beings is likely to fail because we are fallen creatures.
Right.
And bad ideas do propagate, and they propagate more easily than good ideas. And killing and violence and screaming and more powerful, they feel better, but they don't solve anything. They're negative.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maturity, developing a perspective and being mature and being able to handle problems is not something most human beings aspire to achieve. Now, eventually, you know, parenting is a good exercise in that because you eventually have to learn how to rise above your children, or you're reduced to the emotions of your children and you're screaming about insane things that a two-year-old's caring about.
Right.
And you finally realize that's probably not a good idea.
Right.
You may develop a different approach to dealing with the two-year-old. You know, but the point is, it's not necessarily a human being's first impulse.
Mm-hmm.
And then increasingly, as we develop into a highly sophisticated technical world with the metaverse, you know, we're tempting people to escape into this unreality. The potential to control people in a negative way and not to have people self-actualize as mature adults is, you know, we're destroying schools, we're destroying universities, we're destroying medicine. And that's the result of these ideas. Why I wrote this book, to say that if you follow these ideas, you're going to end up in nuclear war. And somebody will decide to destroy everything. Because that's the ultimate culmination of all these ideas. It's self-loathing. It's hating God, which is a form of hating ourselves. You know, we didn't get empowered to create this place. We could have done better. We could have done better than God. We wouldn't have had people die. The understanding of why you have to die is fundamental to understanding that this experience is not about here. It's about a more spiritual element. It's about a more spiritual development. And that's what was fundamental to the original Kabbalah. Okay. It's why people like Leo Strauss studied Maimonides. Because Maimonides was an original thinker in the Kabbalah.
Kabbalist, yeah.
But he was not magical Kabbalah. He was not trying to produced gold as an alchemist.
Mm-hmm.
He was trying to understand what a truly mature, self-actualized human being looked like.
I'm just going to clarify for people, when you say self-actualized, you don't mean in like a Maslowian type of humanist. They've inverted what self-actualization is. Yeah.
Everything with the Kabbalah has been perverted into dark magic. Yeah. Okay. Whereas the original concept was to realize our participation in God's existence.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a higher special meaning to all of this that can only be achieved through death, in a sense, that we have to, our idea that this, our physical bodies, that this is the ultimate experience, has to die when we see a higher perspective of our spiritual lives. And that's a transformation that goes on in a human being that involves recognizing. It's a spiritual transformation. It's a transformation of being able to conceptualize. And the Bible is probably the best expression of it without being obvious. So when it talks, when, you know, God or the angels show up and they say, "Fear not," well, there's no reason to fear, because whatever happens to you here is not the ultimate worst thing that can happen. If you deal with the challenges here, nothing can happen to you because you've advanced yourself spiritually. And that's the only thing that's really important about this experience. You don't get to take the money with you. You don't get to take your loved ones with you. You get to take your experience with you. And that experience has to prepare you to enter into a higher level of consciousness, a higher spiritual level of consciousness, which is where God exists. Now, these are mystical concepts.
Mm-hmm.
But they're mystical concepts that are inherent in what the Bible's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible's always talking about the Psalms. You know, God's always walking with you into the valley of death. Well, you could die. Now, why would God do that? Well, because it's not whether you live or die that's the important issue here. What's important is how you understand the experience. Or Job, who goes through all these hard things and doesn't lose his faith in God.
Mm-hmm.
Stands that believing in God was not Joel Osteen and being able to drive a luxury automobile.
Right. So how would you distinguish the Kabbalah, the original Kabbalah, from Zoroastrianism?
Zoroastrianism was the beginning of saying there's good and bad as a duality.
Mm-hmm.
And Zoroastrianism, which was the original religion of Iran, was actually a fairly interesting and had roots in the Bible. A lot of the Bible derived from Zoroastrian ideas, because the Bible is, in a sense, Zoroastrian, in that there's good and evil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now part of the woke is to blur these distinctions.
Right.
There's all kinds of grades of good and evil. There's 50 shades of gray.
Right.
And so we can behave sexually that way too, because there's no real rules.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well.
And that's theosophy as well. That's the whole New Age movement to blur all the boundaries, and then, you know, there's no reality, there's no truth.
But again, it wasn't the original theosophy, because what Jacob Boehm perceived was that the higher spiritual reality transcended to the rules of God, transcended into a God awareness. It transcended into, you know, more of living a life that was God determined, okay, and participating in that life even here, making this experience a spiritual experience and conceptualizing it as such. And the difficulty is that that idea is very susceptible to being morphed by Hegel into these perfection and history ideas, or we can create our own perfection, because it's all just, you know, it's not good, bad. It's all kinds of different variations.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, the blurring of language, language perversion is fundamental.
Yes.
To this transformation, because we want to see, you know, pedophiles as you know, you minority or child.
Minor attracted person.
Yes, exactly. Minor attracted person. Well, that then creates an identity, a sexual identity. And we have to honor that sexual identity. Well, we should put that person in prison because they've just destroyed and stolen the life of a child.
Right.
Okay. But again, the self-glorification part of all these ideas, where Hegel wanted to be the transformative, he's the one transforming history because he understood it and wrote it down. Marx, Marcuse, these people want to make themselves gods.
Yep.
They're transhumanizing themselves into the center of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And as such, that's Unconstrained Analytics. That's Coughlin and Higgins' book. And their work is quite good. Higgins.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
Higgins died.
I did a bunch of podcasts with them. Not with Higgins, but with.
Well, I knew Higgins quite well.
Did you?
We talked a lot. And even when he was in the White House. And Coughlin continued to talk to and refer to them in the book many times.
Yeah.
Coughlin put on X the other day that I refer to him more than 100 times in the book. I do.
You do. I know. Yeah.
His work is very, very, very important.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
And
I met Higgins once, but I didn't know him. I know Coughlin, but their work is phenomenal. Yeah. They do a really great job of taking very, very complex abstract concepts and distilling it. Yeah.
And I'm trying to do the same, although it takes a little bit of effort to master your way through these ideas because they're inherently difficult.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way to get there without spending the time to thinking about them.
Yeah.
But once you do, there's a tremendous reward to it because these are fundamental questions about human existence, about existence itself. And as such, they have to be explored because, you know, and they're probably enduring. They're probably not going to go away. It's probably not going to be a time when these kinds of questions aren't being considered.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't know that we quite answered, and I'm very curious your thoughts because there just seemed to be a very concerted attack on Western civilization in particular. I have some thoughts as to why that is, but yeah, I'm curious why in particular, because that's mostly what you focus on is the history of Western philosophy and the impact that that's had on our society and our culture. And I would argue to a large extent, actually, geopolitics as well.
Well, Western philosophy, Western civilization has been the primary driver of civilization for the world. And the invention of capitalism, which allows for individual initiative and personal reward, the idea of that our rights are from God and they're inalienable, the documents that our founding fathers created came from an understanding of many of these questions. I mean, they were working specifically out of the natural law theory, Hobbes, Locke, and those types of thinkers predominantly. Hume, who I don't discuss, but Hume also had quite a lot to say on phenomenology and but he just didn't follow in this tradition as squarely as did Kant and Hegel.
I think Hume was a little bit more, grounded in he had a metaphysics that was more pertaining to empiricism, things that could be,
But the point is that the tradition, which this book does not cover as extent, I really wanted to go through the negative path through Marx.
Yeah, you but did.
if you go down the path of Burke or Tocqueville and others, they were articulating, and Hobbes and Rousseau Hobbes and Locke to some extent. Rousseau is on the other side.
Yeah,
but they did understand the reason both why government has to be created and why it has to be limited.
Yeah,
and the concept of limited government, they understood also was fragile. One of the fundamental points of the Plato's Republic that they debate over and over again is that when it's working well, it only it's not going to last because it will contain the forces that destroy it. Because it's very hard to reach that balance where the government is limited and the rights that people have are sovereign.
Right.
And the recognition of, you know, the sovereign nature of a human being's existence is something that's antithetical to government accumulating power. And that tension between needing to have organization for a civilization and then having that not turn into totalitarianism is a very, very thin line.
Yes. I think that's a, so sorry, I just want to interject in that because I think in so many ways, Plato has been distorted and perverted because, you know, it's not, I think there's been this idea that's been promulgated that the Republic is an ideal. And that's certainly what the left has used as a model. But I would argue that that's not necessarily what Plato was saying.
No,
you know, he points out the flaws and the potential.
Plato pointed out that the Republic as an idea is very hard to create and doesn't really work for very long.
Right.
The fundamental ideas that are found in Aristotle's Politics, he was the first to study constitutions. We've lost the study of constitutions, but he does articulate in the Politics and in the Nicomachean Ethics the idea of limited government and the separation of powers. He has the executive, judiciary, legislative. These are Aristotelian ideas. And they are crafted in order to limit the powers. So where checks and balances come from.
Right.
And neither Aristotle nor Plato seem to have been great endorsers of democracy. And the ancient world, democracy was looked as mob rule.
Yep.
And even Thucydides, who comments that, you know, Pericles, had he survived the plague that hit Athens during the Peloponnesian War, Athens probably would have won because he had the ability to lead this mob in the right direction.
Yep.
And once he was gone and no one could replace that, the mob went off in bizarre directions.
Yep.
Depending upon the whims of the moment, and they implemented ideas that didn't work. They put Nicias in charge of the fleet that attacked Syracuse, and he was pious and slow. They put Alcibiades in there, who was impulsive and probably sacrilegious. They probably would have taken Syracuse the first couple of hours, but they didn't. And Thucydides points out that flaw. And Thucydides, I think, is probably the best history ever written. And I think the most, he says it's a work for all times, and I think it truly is. But the fundamental ancient idea was that human beings aren't perfectible and government isn't perfectible. Right. And so it's always a mess.
Yeah.
And we just hope that the mess doesn't turn into a huge mess, especially with all the technological capabilities we have today for destruction.
Right.
And, you know, and even biblically, when it comes down to the apocalypse, you know, 2000 years ago, people were thinking about these ideas. And obviously, God was thinking about these ideas because they're inherent to the Logos. And they're working out of the Logos is what we're experiencing. And so, you know, again, I go back to that my attack is not on Western civilization. My attack is on this particular brand of ideology that got off the rails and is today dominating in the woke. And I want people to understand how bizarre the woke is and to realize that it's defeated both on its corruption, its evil nature, and all the horrors that it produces and is capable of producing.
And absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I think I'm going to have to move on because I've got the next one coming up right away.
Okay.
I thoroughly enjoyed this, and thank you for having read the book as comprehensively as you did.
Yeah, thank you for writing it. I really enjoyed it. You did a really fantastic job. It is really incredibly comprehensive. I highly recommend it. Even just as a study of philosophy. And I know you focused on the more negative aspects of human nature and the philosophies of Western civilization. Perhaps we can do a follow-up, because I think the part we didn't get to was the anarchy. And what I'm seeing right now is a movement that is very anarchist to completely, absolve of any type of government at all. And we're seeing this very largely from the what people call the freedom movement, the truther movement, whatever you want to call it. But the people who tend to align on the right, the dissident right, again, they have all sorts of names. And I think that's by design. These labels, I think, are more aptly target audiences for marketing than really rooted in the original philosophical constructs these days. But I think that is an important thing to discuss.
Okay. Antifa and Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a progression. I'm talking about how you go from the fundamental Marxism to neo-Marxism, mm-hmm. tech culture, then cultural Maoism, which is Mao's version of it, and Gramsci.
Yep.
And it ends up in anarchy. And we're headed towards anarchy.
Yeah, it does look that way. So, well, thank you so much. If you have anything else you want to add with, and tell everybody where they can find you. And
Well, I'm on thetruthcentral.com is my podcast, The Truth Central. And every day I do podcasts of the news and try to cover what's current. My Substack is jeromecourseyphd.substack.com. Mm-hmm. And on X, I'm CourseyJerome1, at CourseyJerome1. I'm still being shadow banned on X and most of the other platforms, but the platform that does not shadow ban, I'm finding to be the most legitimate, is CloudHub.com.
Heard that. Yeah. I need to try that. I hear that it is. And do you have any words of optimism or things that we should do to leave us with?
Well, I always say in the end, God always wins, and God will win here too. God can pull the plug on this place anytime he wants. And, God did not create human beings to fail. There's a plan here where it's not meant to fail. And biblically, it gets very bad. The judgment of God's not going to be particularly pretty, but it isn't over. It isn't even over with the apocalypse. It's another beginning. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I believe we're going through end days. We're going through a particular working out of this logos. Mm-hmm. And it is a battle with Satan. It's a spiritual battle. And I believe we emerge from it victorious. And I think already people are beginning to see the insanity of the left, and they're not signing up for it.
Yes, absolutely. Thank goodness for that. And thank you so much for all your work. And thank you all for watching and listening.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.